Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
I don't look a little like Jared at all. He's got caught in the Melbourne air traffic chaos today. He should be here maybe by the vote of thanks. But we'll head on with the evening. We have two speakers and one lapel mic. So we'll have to get around that somehow. Maybe you can just hold it when you're not standing with it on your lapel. Anyway, tonight we're going to kick off with Edna Carew. And she'll speak for about 15 minutes. And then Jim Bain will put his 15 minutes before you. Both Edna and Jim have spoken here before. We thought it was good to get them together because they both brought out books in the past 6 months, on the financial markets and the story of financial Australia. Jim Bain's our founding donor at Sydney Institute. We've had a long and happy relationship with Jim. In retirement, he started to become a writer. So, both the books will be on sale with Janet Grundy Books, etc., right down the back there. Edna is a financial writer from way back, but has also wrote a book back in about 1992 on what's it called? Paul Keating and What's He Really Like. So she's had a rather dangerous life. But her most recent book is called National Market, National Interests. Anyway, together they're going to enlighten us tonight on Australia's financial history. Welcome.
Thanks, Anne. I hope it's enlightening. And thank you for inviting me along this evening. I have to say that when I first met Jim Bain, which was close to 30 years ago, it never crossed my mind that we'd be sharing a podium such as this. Jim was already a leading figure in stockbroking, and I think, if I'm right, headed Bain & Co. And I was a very fresh face on the Australian Financial Review. My credentials for working on the Financial Review were somewhat mixed. A degree in languages from Edinburgh University, 4 years in a merchant bank, 1 year of a Master of Commerce, which I cordially loathe, and a portfolio of rather varied articles for Sydney Morning Herald, Woman's Day and Forum magazine. So in late 1977, I had marched into the dingy Broadway offices of the Australian Financial Review, seeking to find someone and persuade them to offer me a job. The then editor, Max Walsh, who was always alert to an opportunity, said, "I'll give you a go." And that was the start of a daily column, which over time became a section of several pages, covering all aspects of the capital markets in Australia and overseas. At that time, ASX, whose history is a major focus of national market, national interest, didn't exist as such. The concept of a national exchange was a gleam in the eyes of a few far-sighted people, but there were several obstacles to its creation, not the least the type of interstate rivalry that Jim alludes to in his latest book. And the markets themselves, frankly, were a bit Mickey Mouse. We had a clutch of banks, some growing merchant banks, and finance companies, the share market that still had the colourful trading floors, as you would well remember, and an over-the-counter telephone-connected money market trading cash and bills of exchange and fixed income securities. And some of those bonds and debentures were traded on the stock exchange, and the currency hedge market was just beginning to blossom in 1979. We didn't have then a foreign exchange market as such. In fact, in the late 1970s, the term financial markets was yet to be born. The average investor was very familiar with the share market, thanks to all the booms and busts that we had. But money market was sort of shrouded in mystery. And in fact, when I started my column, it took me about 25 calls in the course of an afternoon to establish about 30 different opinions of what an interest rate had been traded at during the day or a bill rate or so forth. And then on the following morning I would get wakened up by abusive irate phone calls from dealers who didn't like such information being disclosed, or from their clients who now realise they've been ripped off. How that's all changed. The information that was then so hard to find, of course, is now at one's fingertips. One innovation that really did revolutionise, which I know is an overworked word, but it really did revolutionise the landscape, was the introduction in 1980 of Australia's first cash management trust by what was then Hill Samuel and, of course, is now Macquarie Bank. That's brought the kind of wholesale professional money market interest rates into the within the grasp of the average investor. And over time, of course, the arcane world of financial markets became less opaque, although increasingly complex and sophisticated. As for the stock exchanges, they were a product of the history of six self-governing colonies who decided in 1901, as you know, to form federation and try and put to rest colony and interstate fighting. Several regional exchanges sprang up thanks to gold rushes in Bendigo and Ballarat, and of course places like Newcastle, which had a lot of industry, at one stage listed 300 companies. So the saga of the maturing of our financial markets spans several decades, and so we now have an extremely dynamic financial centre with a high-profile currency, which is not always hugely desirable, and just about every bank and investment bank and fund manager in the world has some sort of presence in this country. The idea of a national stock exchange was in the air really from the early 1970s, possibly earlier, but in my research that's when it cropped up. And several people were promoting the idea that it was a waste of resources and inefficient to have six exchanges spanning a country as small as this. And as time went by, Jim Bain, who we'll talk to in a minute, was increasingly wont to say it's not a question of Sydney versus Melbourne or Brisbane versus Perth, but Australia versus the world. But a key factor for me in the research was the letter that a furious investor wrote in the early 1970s, a Dr. Max Anderson in Perth, who alleged that there had been insider trading in Poseidon shares, and he wrote to the then Federal Attorney General Lionel Murphy because he couldn't get any joy out of either of the exchanges he contacted. And Murphy responded to this and began a Senate inquiry which led to the landmark Ray report, which uncovered a lot of the chaos and mayhem and malpractices and so forth that had gone on, as it happens in every boom. But my story grew like Topsy under my very eyes, because it wasn't just about creating a national exchange. It was a much broader story about states' rights and federal power, and of course advances in technology and how these could be applied to the securities markets. And the story, which one cynic, as I got towards the end of my research, summed up by saying, oh, come on, they just bribed the stockbrokers till they've agreed with it all, actually involves much more serious issues. One bizarre twist is that the securities markets actually narrowly escaped a very firm legislative straitjacket had Lionel Murphy's proposed legislation gone through. The formal title was the Companies and Securities Industry Bill, and it was actually passed in the House of Representatives in February 1975 and was due to be heard in the Senate on the morning of November the 11th, 1975. But of course that day the government of the day was dismissed, and the Murphy Bill, which would have been quite draconian, died with it. One early move that was fought vigorously was to try to merge the Sydney and Melbourne Stock Exchange floors. It seems incredible now, but brokers actually arbitraged the two markets. Now we have a global world. But the Melbourne and Sydney just didn't talk to each other. The two chairmen didn't speak to each other. Such was the depth of the animosity. And in fact, one development that went against Melbourne, and I can say this fairly safely as we're in Sydney, was when Sydney proposed to start an options market, and they actually offered Melbourne 50% of the floor or the development, and Melbourne said no because it thought options were a bit casino-like. So it missed out. This was all bewildering to an outsider, and a man called Ronald Koppel, whom you may have heard of, played a key role in forging a national market, and he'd come to Australia from Belfast in the late 1960s and was very stunned to discover the extent of petty rivalries in what he believed to be one country, Australia. On budget night 1985, he was sitting in the living room of the then chairman of the Melbourne Exchange, Ian Roach's living, waiting for the press to ring about the budget. And Ian Roach said to him, "I have a problem. We are going to develop an electronic trading system which will span the whole of Australia. How can we make this work with six fighting city-based stock exchanges, state-based stock exchanges?" Anyhow, that was the beginning of ASX. At a further meeting a few months later, Ronald Koppel and his team summoned to Sydney all the committee members of the various exchanges, and as one fellow related to me, basically locked them up in the Intercontinental until they agreed to form a national exchange, which was born on the 1st of April 1987. A few months later, the National Electronic Trading System was launched, coincidentally on the day of the start of the stock market crash on Monday the 19th of October 1987. So it was a baptism of fire, but the system survived and it thrived. What the share market crash did highlight, though, was chaos in the settlement of the shares, and at that point Australia's reputation was woeful for backlogs and all the kinds of problems that get associated with a boom and a bust. I'll just let some people find a seat. There's some seats down the front, as usual.
Like church.
Yes, that's right. Or school. School. Another world first for Australia, of which we can be proud, was the and after several years of many years of work, was the introduction in 1998 of the Holy Grail in share settlement, T+3 settlement, as you know, 3 days after the shares are traded. CHESS, the system, was a triumph for the team who developed it. There were many ups and downs along the way, not least when the UK's proposed system, Taurus, was actually scrapped in 1993 after years of work and spending several millions of pounds. There was, of course, the view that if London couldn't do it, then how could Australia possibly get it up and running? But they did, with a team of 35 compared to London's 300. And that owes much to Angus Richards at ASX and his team. And Angus's favourite phrase, response to anything when somebody said you should be doing something more quickly, was, "Yes, that is a good idea, but I'm not doing it now." And that paid off. Then in 1990, the Commonwealth did take over the whole field of companies and securities law, just as Lionel Murphy had proposed, but in a substantially modified form and introduced by another Labour Federal Attorney General, Lionel Bowen. And then again, a world first in 1998 when the ASX demutualised and listed, of course not without a bun fight as usual. I'm encapsulating in this short time a huge tapestry of history. I haven't mentioned the benefit that the markets have received over the years from various industry associations who've come and gone, and of course successive government inquiries and reports which have added to the momentum for change. When one launches a book, which fortunately was a few months ago, everyone of course hopes it's going to be a great success and that people enjoy it, maybe learn something from it. And sometimes the book does take wings and sometimes it just sinks like a stone. It was a very irritated Jim Bain who rang me a few months ago saying, "Why don't these worthy books, such as we're discussing tonight, get the media attention they deserve?" But frankly, they don't lend themselves to the short, snappy, sexy headlines that newspapers like. And one columnist friend candidly said to me, "We really like to bag people, not write something nice." So, characteristic Jim Bain, he decided to do something about this and got into the ear of Sydney Institute, so hence we're meeting tonight. So I would just like to finish by saying that 30-odd years ago, when I trotted into Max Walsh's office and said to him, "Writing about the money market, what exactly does that involve?" And he said, "There's more to the money markets than you think." And I didn't doubt at all that he was right, but at the time I'd only the vaguest idea of what he meant. But as the years rolled on, the markets have assumed increasing significance globally as well as obviously domestically. And that's called for a lot of hard work and commitment and on the part of many market practitioners who've helped educate people who come into the markets as well as investors and students. And the outcome is that Australia does punch well above its weight in international markets. And the markets, in fact, do have an extremely robust story of growth to tell.
I've got to get this on first. It's not as easy as you think. Can you hear me? A bit higher? How's that?
Well done.
Good. Well, thank you, Gerard, for inviting me to join Edna tonight. He'll be here shortly. As you probably know, he's been held up in the Melbourne plane crisis today. You may well ask, what is Jim Bain doing here? The reasons are, firstly, from about the time I reached the age of 74 years in 2003, I found that my many interesting jobs, even the voluntary ones, were disappearing. Secondly, I realised that there was no retiring age for authors, and provided I did all the research and typing for this book, it would satisfy my workaholic tendencies for the next 4 years. Thirdly, I felt our industry story had to be told, as my first book, published in 2001, was all about my personal business experiences, and there seemed to be no other books about the finance industry in which I had spent 40 years. You may well ask the question, was my book going to make any money? I'm afraid this is not very likely, because in spite of the efforts of John Elliott, Heather Cam, and the excellent staff at the University of New South Wales Press, under the terms of the contract, I had to subsidise the cost of the book because, firstly, I insisted on having 70 photographs of the major personalities, and the normal publishing contract allows for a maximum of 25 photographs, including illustrations such as charts, of which there were 51. Secondly, I wanted the book to be produced at the same excellent standard and format as Australia's First Bank, from the Bank of New South Wales to Westpac, by Davidson and Salisbury, also published by the University of New South Wales Press in 2005, but paid for by the bank in that case. And thirdly, I wanted the book to be fully indexed and have to employ an indexing specialist. Although my wife Jeanette, who's here tonight, had read the draft many times and cut out many contentious issues, my final version was still about 150,000 words in length, and the publishing contract had a limit of no more than 120,000 words. Fortunately, my friend Howard Gelman, a specialist in business writing from Macquarie University, did an excellent job in reducing the length of the book to about 98,000 words and made it much more interesting reading. However, on the positive side, in case you're starting to feel sorry for me, as the author, I received 10% royalty on all books sold up to 2,500 and 12% on sales figures above that. As a result of my careful study of the local banks, I decided about 2 years ago to buy significant parcels of shares in St George Bank and Macquarie, and I've done very well on both of these investments. Although I must say, I sold Macquarie at $80, they went to 97, but they're well below 80 now, so I think I'm still glad to be out. No lack of respect for that organisation. Howard Gelman, when editing, had removed the early history about Captain James Cook's discovery of the east coast of Australia, the First Fleet, and Governor Arthur Phillip, on the grounds that these matters had nothing to do with the financial centres of Sydney and Melbourne. You'll be surprised to know this unused material has formed the basis for my third book. Uncertain Beginnings, How Australia Might Have Been Discovered by the Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch or French, and was only by luck it was the British. This book will include old maps and quotes from books, journals, etc., and will probably keep me busy for another 2 years, although it is well underway. Before the book was published, there was some drama over the design for the front cover. I had originally suggested having photographs of the financial districts of Sydney and Melbourne on the cover. This was rejected in favour of having the logos of the major banks, merchant banks and stockbrokers, say 9 from Sydney, 7 from Melbourne. But when I rang the institution to get copies of their logos, they refused on the grounds they had not approved the story about their institution. And in any case, they did not know what the pecking order would be. After this setback, the designers decided to put a colourful artist's impression of the famous Commonwealth Bank's money box on the front cover of the book. Many of you may remember this object from your early years, and I was supposed to hold up a book, but I forgot to bring one, but you'll see it later. You can see an author's life, it's not meant to be easy. I'll now mention some of the major interesting points of history from my book. Sydney was the only major town in the colony for the first 45 years up to 1837, when Melbourne was established. Although the Bank of New South Wales was established in 1817, for its first 40 or 50 years it concentrated on business from Sydney and New South Wales. However, the Anglo banks, established in Melbourne in 1835 and 1837, soon expanded to the other colonies. Melbourne overtook Sydney because of the great wealth coming from the Victorian gold discoveries, which began in 1851. This position was strengthened by the Anglo banks and the activities of the remarkable stockbroker Jonathan Binns Weir. Melbourne's leading role was later expanded when Weir's dominance was challenged by other leading stockbrokers, Ian Potter, later Sir Ian, from the 1940s, and Arthur Good from the 1960s. Sydney started to catch up with the arrival of Charles Ord in the 1960s and the expansion of Bain & Company in the 1970s. Also from the 1970s, the Sydney Stock Exchange started to adopt much more progressive and innovative policies, and these assisted its members to compete more equally with the major Melbourne firms. Then from the mid-1980s, the vast majority of merchant banks and newly approved foreign banks chose to set up in Sydney. The growth of the Sydney Futures Exchange from the 1980s was also a significant factor in attracting more business to Sydney. The overseas control merchant banks. In recent years, it has really been the Australian operations of the larger overseas controlled merchant banks which have dominated the list of Australia's top merchant banks and stockbrokers, as shown below. Citigroup, which is probably the largest bank in the world now, led in the early days from 1985 by John Thomas, its first managing director, and later by Rob Thomas, who has been its chairman since 2003. Credit Suisse First Boston, which firmly established itself in Australia by Ross Bradfield. Merrill Lynch, which opened for business in Sydney in the early 1970s, managed by Bill Bonsack. UBS, which acquired Potter Warburg in 1995-96. And Deutsche Bank, which had acquired Bain & Company in 1996, and its chief executive, Ken Border, had come across from Bain's. And Goldman Sachs, who acquired J.B. Weir in 2003, and is run by Terry Campbell from Weir's. J.P. Morgan, which had acquired Australia's first merchant bank, Australian United Corporation, was managed by Scott Reed until 2002, and then Rob Priestley became a CEO. And only Macquarie Bank is the Australian-owned and controlled bank, or merchant bank, in the top 10 stockbrokers merchant banks. The Sydney banks. Although the Bank of New South Wales was established much earlier in 1817, the London-controlled Melbourne-based Anglo banks, the Bank of Australasia and the Union Bank of Australia, had adopted much more expansionary policies and had overtaken the Wales by June 1872. The two Anglos later merged in 1951 to form the ANZ Bank. However, the Wales-Westpac Bank became by far the largest Australian bank after its frenetic expansion in the late 1980s. But after the drama of the huge write-off and losses from the 1987 crash, which occurred in the period from 1990 to 1992, Westpac is now back to being a well-run bank under David Morgan, but is now ranked fourth position in market capitalisation terms behind the Commonwealth Bank, the NAB and ANZ. Earlier, the Commercial Banking Company of Sydney, founded in 1834, had been a very successful bank and with very strong connections in New South Wales, but it was taken over in a very important move by the NAB in 1981. The Commonwealth Bank, after a slow start, really started to expand, taking over numerous other savings banks after the federal government sold its shares to the public. The bank has produced excellent results in recent years under the leadership of David Murray and has now overtaken the NAB to become Australia's largest financial institution. It's interesting that at the end of when I finished my book in December 2006, there was nothing between the NAB and the Commonwealth in market capitalisation terms. But if you look in the paper now, you'll find the Commonwealth Bank is now $7 billion ahead of the National, being way ahead, which is quite extraordinary. The Melbourne banks, the big story of this chapter is how the National Bank grew from its position in market capitalisation terms in 1971 in seventh place behind three other major banks and two of the biggest finance companies to become our largest financial institution in 2004 because it came through the 1987 crash in much better shape than its competitors. This was largely because of the strong but conservative leadership of Nobby Clark from 1985 to 1990 and Don Argus from 1990 to 1999. The bank had made much larger provisions for the bad debts from the 1987 crash and had avoided much of the high-risk lending embarked on by its major competitors. However, as mentioned earlier, the Commonwealth Bank has now overtaken the NAB to assume number one placing. Melbourne's ANZ Bank has also performed very well in recent deals under its Managing Director John McFarlane and Chairman Charles Good and is now in third place behind the Commonwealth and the NAB. New banks. In recent years, the Sydney-based St George Bank developed from a merger of several large building societies into a major player, particularly in the area of home lending. Since 2002, Gail Kelly has been very effective CEO of St George and was strongly supported by Frank Conroy, the bank's chairman from 1996 to 2004. Frank had previously been the managing director of Westpac from 91 to 92. By June 2006, St George was ranked as Australia's sixth largest financial institution with a market capitalisation of $15.4 billion and was our 15th largest listed company. Sydney's Macquarie Bank is also quite a remarkable story because the senior staff were able to acquire the successful business from its owner, the UK-based merchant bank Hill Samuel, after 16 years of successful trading in 1985. Under the leadership of David Clark and Mark Johnson, the business was further expanded by acquiring the best and brightest people available and not only paying them well but granting all the senior staff share options to buy into the thriving business. Macquarie Bank has developed into Australia's only really significant privately owned and controlled merchant bank, fund manager and the creator of many independently listed infrastructure funds. Along the way, Macquarie had acquired the Ailing Bankers Trust, Australian investment banking business. Macquarie Bank shares were listed in July 1996 and by 2006 June, the bank was Australia's fifth largest financial institution and 13th largest listed company with a market capitalisation of $16.8 billion, closely followed by St George in sixth place. The incredible growth of this institution in total assets and profits over the last 5 years has astounded us all. No wonder they call it the Millionaire's Factory. And of course, I've just, by as a side issue, because St George and Macquarie have come along so strongly in Sydney, if you add those together to the other major banks, it sort of swings the balance more Sydney's way in the banking sector. Fund managers. In the first part of this chapter, I've selected four large fund managers to discuss: Maple Brown Abbott, Perpetual Trustee, Colonial First State, and Washington H. Soul Pattinson and Company. The next section covers a selection of boutique fund managers. I won't mention them all here tonight. But all these boutique fund managers have certain things in common. They really live their job, and that means 24 hours a day in some cases. They visit the management of the companies they invest in regularly. They can identify small stocks which are neglected and undervalued. And they are usually very flexible in how many stocks they hold and the size of their holding. The fact that Sydney is the convincing winner in the struggle to become Australia's leading financial centre is mainly because we adopted a much more welcoming approach to new merchant banks, foreign banks and fund managers over the years. With the dominance of the Potter, Weir and Good brokers in Melbourne, there was a feeling that, you know, we want to keep the outsiders out, we've got all the business anyway, so don't let anyone come in and pinch our business. Whereas Sydney said, the more people we get here, the bigger the market, and that really was a completely different attitude. Now finally, to illustrate the growth of Australia's financial sector, I've produced the following figures. The total market capitalisation of Australia's listed banks The first figure available is the 30th of June 1872. Believe it or not, the total of all the banks was 17.66 million Australian dollars, obviously converted from pounds. By 2006, 30th of June, the total market valuation of the Australian banks, is listed ones, is $241.525 billion. The annual contribution of the finance and insurance sector to Australia's GDP growth, and this is on an annual basis, in 1974, 31st December, it was 4.609 billion Australian dollars. By 2006, it's 17.149 billion. And the annual turnover of the stock exchange, Sydney only in December 1965, was $233 million a year. By the 30th of June 2006, now being ASX, of course, it is $967.3 billion. The above remarkable figures show how important Australia's financial sector has become to our nation. In conclusion, I thank you for coming this evening and hope that those of you who do purchase a signed copy of my book later tonight will find it interesting to read. Thank you.
Is it now?
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.